From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells.
Our next guest is Jess Phoenix, who has dedicated her career to making scientific exploration accessible to as many people as possible. That work has taken her to the jungles and glaciers across the globe, as well as to the university classrooms and television studios. She's found herself at glittering cocktail parties in Manhattan's Elite Explorers Club, and she's found herself fixing a flat tire on the side of the world's largest volcano with a ballpoint pen, bubblegum, and duct tape. She joins us now to discuss her new book, Ms. Adventure, My Wild Explorations in Science, Lava, and Life. Jess Phoenix, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
Well, we're delighted to have you on the program. And a lot of people stand on the sidelines of life, but you don't. Where did you get your passion for science, for activism, for risk?
I think that I just had a higher tolerance for activities that maybe a lot of people think are risky from a young age. Both of my parents were FBI agents, and seeing them go to work with handguns and bulletproof vests and talk about terrorism as a dinner table conversation, that was pretty formative, I would say. And then it was just sort of taught to me at a young age because I played a lot of sports. And so I had this internal belief that you can accomplish amazing things if you put in the time and the energy and the hours and you keep going. So I think that all has served me very well. Now, the science part, can't really say where that came from aside from watching Mr. Wizard when I was really little.
Right.
But I think it's more of a the ends justify the means, in that I want to know the answers to everything. I mean, why are mountains where they are, and why do oceans form, and how do volcanoes work? Those are questions I had as a kid, and as an adult, I love uncovering the answers.
And you're not one to just take a look at scientific data. You believe in boots on the ground. You believe in being there and recording your observations. Is that correct?
Well, as much as I can, that's what my preference is. Now, obviously, some places it's not practical to go to, or even possible in some instances. And there is a lot of great work that gets done via remote sensing using satellites, et cetera. But there is something that you just can't replace about being there in person. And so that is, if I have any way at all of getting to a place as close as possible, that's my strong preference, because you can really pick up on some subtleties that often are lost if you are just using cameras and imaging. So, yep, if I can get my boots dirty, then sign me up.
Jess, you are the founder of Blueprint Earth. Tell us about that.
It's kind of my answer to seeing up close and personal how natural resources are extracted. I worked in Australia in coal mining and in hard rock mining around the world. And I know that we do need to extract some resources. It's just a fact of our existence in the 21st century. I mean, everybody wants to use their smartphones and their TVs, and that's not going away. So we need to be able to extract resources and to exist in close proximity to these beautiful natural environments without destroying everything. So I used what I learned in academia, kind of looking at the big picture of science and the whys and the hows, and married that with the really practical science that you do when you're working in mining, and said, all right, let's systematize how we look at environments. How do they function as a system? And while we're doing that, can we give field research opportunities and learning experiences to college and university students who wouldn't normally have access to field camp, which is often extremely expensive in geology, I know. And I assumed the same was true for biology camp and things like that. So I said, let's see if we can make this available at no cost to students. So that's what Blueprint Earth does. We've been cataloging an environment in California's Mojave Desert that has flowing water and bighorn sheep and bobcats and really cool soil crusts that are alive. And we've been doing that for, gosh, this is going into our eighth year. And we've worked with over 350 students from around the country and a few international students as well.
It's really interesting what you're talking about. I've known a lot of people who study geology because they are fascinated, like you are, by the earth and what makes it up. And then they get out of college and they realize the really great opportunity, job opportunities are in mining, and they don't want to go that route. And they end up giving it up altogether. As you say, you found a reasonable hybrid about the geology involved in mining and the extractive resources and sort of what you do. I'm just wondering if you could talk about that a little bit, how you made peace with that whole world of extraction.
I don't know if I've totally made peace with it. It's more of, I realize that it's something that it's necessary at this point. I mean, we can't synthesize rare earth elements. It's not something that we just have the ability to do. And it's sort of like we need to consume to exist. And so I think that it's more of a broad reaching life philosophy that I've developed as I've gotten older, and that really says that we can try to maybe not eliminate our impact on Earth and what it has to offer, but we can really balance the way that we use the various things that Earth gives us and try to do it in a way that is as minimally disruptive as possible. And I think it's just about optimizing our processes. It sounds like business school or something, process improvement. But in reality, it's something that we can look at in all different aspects of our lives. And whether I'm working on a volcano and, trying to sit there and get work done, collect data in the face of, overwhelming raw power and natural beauty, or whether I'm looking at something, coal data, mining data, to try to explain to investors, this mine, you're going to spend more money cleaning it up than you will actually making profits. And so it's using that ability to see the balance, I think, that is something that comes when you've dipped your toe in the waters. You can't really look from the outside in and have the same perspective as if you actually experience what the current process is. So that's why, despite I didn't like the environmental aspects when I did work in mining, but I really learned a lot. And that has allowed me to carry that different perspective forward as I teach students.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Jess Phoenix. She has written Ms. Adventure, My Wild Explorations in Science, Lava, and Life. And Jess, you talk about your first visit to Mauna Loa on the Big Island, and that it's a shield volcano, looks like a shield on its side versus the inverted V that you would have of a stratovolcano. Across the world, what percentage of our volcanoes are shield and what percentage are the inverted V strato?
That's actually a very challenging question because some areas are home to more than one type. There are aspects of shield volcano that like real classic features and also stratovolcano features on the same volcano in the case of Italy's Mount Etna. And there are even smaller features that are sometimes distinct that form on shield volcanoes. So you can get a cinder cone on a shield volcano. So it's not like every volcano can be categorized as one or the other, which makes it a little bit tricky. Now, of course, the volcanoes that most people are going to think of are the big visible stratovolcanoes, the pointy ones that every little kid draws. And that's just because those are usually easier to spot. But the very biggest volcanoes, the calderas that have collapsed during massive, massive eruptions, are often kind of hidden by the landscape because they're so big. So the same thing happens with shield volcanoes as well. If they're not currently erupting or have the potential to erupt, then they often blend into the landscape. So a lot of people won't even notice that they're around.
And Yellowstone's a perfect example of that. Lynn and I live several hours from the western gate of Yellowstone and the southern gate. And I understand that the Yellowstone caldera, so this is sort of a one of my geeky questions, is that they have estimated that caldera to be so large through their instrumentation packages and some kind of technology, which I wanted to ask you about how they do this, but it was enough to fill the Grand Canyon 11.2 times. And that tells me that even though the chances of it erupting are very small, if it were to erupt, we'd be in big trouble here in Park City, wouldn't we?
Well, yes, if it did one of those very, very large eruptions, the cataclysmic supervolcano level eruptions, there's a scale that we use as volcanologists to measure how large these eruptions are. It's called the VEI, the Volcanic Explosivity Index. And it depends on the amount of debris that the volcano ejects in an eruption. So your typical Hawaiian eruption, like what's going on day to day right now at Kilauea, is on the level of a zero because it produces very little volume of lava. They can go 0 to 1 is pretty common. Mount St. Helens was a 5 on the VEI, and Yellowstone is just, you know, we're talking 7, 8. So those are extremely large eruptions, and it's a logarithmic scale. So it goes up by a factor of 10 every time you hit a new number on the VEI. So we can estimate that by the thickness of ash deposits where we find them. We can use a geochemical analysis to determine if a layer of ash comes from a particular volcanic eruption. In the case of Yellowstone, there's huge layers of ash in what we call tuff, T-U-F-F, and that is ash from a volcano. And of course, this isn't fireplace soot, this is pulverized rock fragments that in the case of tuff, they're so hot and the weight of the ash pressing down on itself welds the ash into a solid unit called tuff. So we can look at these tuff layers and, you know, chip away pieces of them, analyze them in the lab, and get a sense of, do they have the same chemical signature as what we know to have come during an eruption, a specific eruption. So that's how we can kind of see the extent of an eruption's reach and how much material it ejected. So that's one of the ways that we can calculate things that happened literally millions of years ago, like the case of Yellowstone. And so the most likely scenario, because everyone is worried about Yellowstone because the news loves the clickbait headlines like Yellowstone's going to kill us all. Well, it's not. And it's just the most likely eruption we would see in any of our lifetimes for you or me or our listeners is probably a very localized steam-driven eruption that would only be the effects of that would only be felt in the immediate area. So we're not looking at a big supervolcano level eruption from Yellowstone in our lifetimes. So we can take a breath of relief at that.
You know, it's funny you say that, Jess, because I don't know, John, what was it, about 7 years ago or so, we were interviewing on this show a seismologist from the University of Utah, and that's what we were asking him, like, wow, is this the big one? Is this going to get us? And he said the same thing as you, so we should feel, take solace in the fact that it'll just be like Old Faithful times 100. But, you know, you bring up a really interesting point about clickbait and about sort of the juxtaposition of reality and hype and in the news media. And I think having the curiosity that you have and that has always summoned you forth to study everything that you've been studying is an example of how we all ought to conduct our lives a little bit more. You know, instead of just reading the headlines, asking the questions. And I tend to think that you wrote this book, not just for the average person, but maybe also for young women, that you want to see other young women as they go into sort of career choices or just life, asking these deeper questions about science.
I think you've definitely touched on some really important aspects of why I did write the book. And it's not just young women, it really is people who think that all of the exploration on Earth has been done. They see the investment, the huge staggering dollar amounts invested in space exploration, and they think, oh, well, we already know everything here on Earth. And young women often don't have role models of field scientists. And if you think about it, if I said, oh, name a fictional scientist in a movie, they'd say Indiana Jones. And I mean, he's an archaeologist. He's definitely not a geologist. And, you know, punching Nazis is a relatively small aspect of my job, I would say. hasn't happened too often. But that's the thing, is we have also in our pop culture, if you ask a lot of young people to name scientists, they're going to pick physicists. They'll say like Neil deGrasse Tyson, maybe Carl Sagan, if their parents were huge Carl Sagan fans and they've somehow heard of him. And they may pull out Bill Nye the Science Guy, but they won't really think of women first and foremost, even though, you know, Diane Fossey and Jane Goodall have been household names, Sally Ride, Marie Curie, but these are not the people who come to mind oftentimes. So it's really showing people that one, exploration, especially in the, you know, for science purposes, we're not talking about the colonial type of exploration here, but all scientific exploration still needs people to fund it, to do it, and to talk about it. And the same thing is true for who we need. We don't just need the same old people who we think of when we think of scientists and people who do exploration. We need people to realize that any human is born with the instinct to explore and to ask questions in a scientific way. I mean, is the world around us, is it kind? Is it harsh? Does the food that we put in our mouths, does it taste good or bad? And is this thing even food when you're really little? So that's looking at the world with a scientific mindset of testing a hypothesis, as saying, you know, if I put this thing in my mouth, will it taste good or bad? And babies do that all the time. And so I think if we just recognize that exploration and scientific inquiry are part of our DNA as humans, and it's up to us to keep those fires of curiosity burning throughout our lives and encourage the young people in our lives to feel that way as well, that it's okay to ask these questions, that it's necessary and good, then we'll be doing okay as a society. But we really do need to push curiosity as the cure for the disease of ignorance that we see far too often these days.
Very well said. Well, you also somehow ended up in being named to the Explorers Club. And I'm kind of curious about that, how that came to be, and how does it help forward the kind of work that you do? Or is it just a means to brush elbows and hopefully keep that scientific curiosity and inquiry going?
Well, I'm not exactly sure what made me think of the club. I think it's all the reading I did as a kid. I was really into Robert Louis Stevenson and Jules Verne and, I mean, Jack London. I read all the adventure and exploration books. I read everything as a kid. And I think I thought that the Explorers Club was not real or that it was gone. And I looked into it in 2015 and found out that it was still around. And I read the criteria for entry and thought, I actually think I meet these criteria. Weird. And so the club was founded in 1904, and it's the US's answer to the Royal Geographical Society, essentially, that, you know, was in England and has been around for a long time. And of course, both clubs had their origins in a more colonial era. So they've shifted their focuses to really be, especially the Explorers Club, to really be focused on exploration in the name of science. So your exploration, it doesn't count if you're just going on a paid safari and you take photos. That doesn't count. It has to be scientific research that you're doing, and you have to add to the body of knowledge about our world or about space or the bottom of the ocean. So I applied, and you have to have existing people say that, you know, you are qualified. They have to sponsor you. And so I had to get two sponsors to join the club as a fellow, and they accepted me. And the fellow is the highest level of membership. And there are about, I think, 3,500 members and fellows in the club worldwide. So it's a pretty small group. So you get a chance to really meet a lot of different people in different fields. So you may meet an archaeologist excavating Scythian burial tombs in Siberia, and then meet a storm chaser from Canada who works in the plains of the US. And you can talk with all of these people, and it's networking too, because they may need something I have expertise in on one of their future expeditions, or vice versa. So we can really help each other continue this really valuable, sometimes time-sensitive environmental research and research on things that may get destroyed. Like with the current eruption in Iceland, there was a supposed old quote-unquote Viking burial mound that was in danger of being overtaken by lava from this eruption. And it was, but they were trying to get archaeologists out there to double check before this little tiny bit of human history was just obliterated by nature. So there is a lot of time-sensitive work that needs to be done because we live on such a dynamic, changing planet. So the Explorers Club is just another way to connect with people to try to get that work accomplished.
And you included a beautiful letter that was written in 1981 from Carl Sagan to allow women to be, to be able to get into this very exclusive club that's been all male. And, Carl Sagan was just an amazing person. Every time I hear something about something that he did outside of the cosmos, it just amazes me. He was a very active person, and he's probably responsible for getting women to be able to join this spectacular club.
There was a lot of resistance because, as humans, another of our traits is that we can be very stubborn and we like things to stay the same, which of course isn't possible. So Carl Sagan was instrumental when he wrote that letter. He made such an eloquent argument about how much of exploration that had already come before 81 was because of women's contributions. And the club was pretty monolithic. It was very much older and male and white. And obviously the image of an explorer in our minds has been that person for a long time. But in reality, the world of exploration should be open to everyone. And if you can start to systematize the way that you learn and the way that you conduct your exploration, well, then you're working on being a scientist. And scientific exploration is really where the challenges lie as we go ahead. So I'm really grateful that Carl Sagan and that the other people who advocated for women to join the club did so. And I try to pass that on now. I'm trying to invite more people of color, more scientists from different backgrounds, and yes, more women and non-binary folks to join the club, because scientists look like all of us. I mean, the true diversity of humanity is who can be a scientist. And we need to get that out there to the world as well.
We certainly do. Jess Phoenix has written Ms. Adventure, My Wild Explorations in Science, Lava, and Life. Lynn and I love the book. We wish you continued success. And thanks so much for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. This was absolutely a blast.
Thanks, Jess.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.